most unobstructed view down a dirt track that ran all the way to the western perimeter of the ranch. Spotting enemies moving through the jumble of hills and ridges to his north and south would be a little trickier, but his thermal and audio sensors should still be able to get a read on them. Warning. Maycomber's computer suddenly pulsed in his consciousness. Movement alert west. Two enemy machines advancing toward our position. Range 600 meters and closing fast. Reacting instantly, he slaved several of his visual sensors to the new contacts. The Russian combat robots had just emerged from behind the sheltering mass of one of the neighboring hills and turned in his direction. They were loping along parallel to the dirt track at roughly 60 kilometers per hour. Maycomber eased his electromagnetic railgun out from under his CID's torso. It powered up with a shrill, high-pitched whine.
Zdravstvuyte, hello, and do svidaniya, and goodbye, he murmured,
sighting quickly on the lead enemy fighting machine. Inside the cockpit of Spectre 6, Major Alexei Bragin felt a sharp sizzle across his brain as the KVM's computer sent an emergency alert through his neural link.
Strong electromagnetic signature detected, it reported. Unknown type. Range 500 meters. Bearing 092 degrees.
A red dot blinked rapidly, centered at the edge of a grove of trees up ahead. Bragin blinked. What kind of enemy sensor was that? He started to raise his 30mm autocannon. And then his view of the woods disappeared, eclipsed by a dazzling, sun-bright white flash. One-third of a second later, a small, super-dense tungsten steel alloy slug smashed through his KVM's torso at Mach 5. Bragin died instantly, vaporized by the massive impact that ripped his robot in half and sprayed molten fragments high into the air. 100 meters behind the blazing wreckage of Spectre 6, Major Dmitry Veselovsky's highly trained instincts kicked in. He spun Spectre 5, his KVM, away from the threat, and darted north toward a rocky spur jutting up from the nearest stretch of high ground. While on the move, he triggered a burst from his autocannon, sending a hail of high-explosive, armor-piercing rounds ripping downrange toward the still-unseen enemy.
Spectre 5 to lead,
he radioed, plunging into cover behind the boulder-strewn spur.
Enemy contact! 6 is down! My computer evaluates the weapon used as a railgun.
Engage and destroy the enemy, 5, Marushiev snapped. That has to be the Iron Wolf machine we were warned about. Kill it while the rest of us destroy the primary target.
Affirmative lead.
Veselovsky pushed on, digging his robot's feet into the crumbling soil as he climbed fast up a wooded draw that offered him a sheltered route straight to the top of the hill. Maycomber flattened as a stumpy oak of cedar trees around him exploded in a hail of splinters and flying debris, shattered by a sudden burst of autocannon fire from the second Russian fighting machine.
That son of a bitch out there sure has fast reflexes, he thought.
Bits of shrapnel pinged off his back armor. Minor damage to rear-facing visual camouflage elements, his computer told him. Wood fragments and razor-sharp pieces of shrapnel had slashed through some of the paper-thin electrochromatic plates layered across the CID's rear torso, head, and legs. He raised up again, just in time to see the Russian combat robot disappear behind a spur of high ground. Quickly, he pulled his railgun to the right and squeezed off another shot.
Hell, who knew? Maybe he could punch a round right through that rise.
Crack! Dirt and shattered rock fountained high into the night sky, spraying away from the deep crater the railgun slug gouged out of the hillside.
No hit, the computer reported.
No shit,
Maycomber growled out loud. With one part of his mind, he zoomed in his tactical display. What he saw made him frown. That enemy machine now had covered a route all the way up to the top of the forested hills that bordered this little valley. And from here, it could move swiftly along the high ground to any number of good vantage points overlooking Farrell's ranch house and its outbuildings. Which left him no choice, he knew. He needed to intercept that Russian robot before it found a clear shot. Moving fast, Maycomber shut down the CID's camouflage systems and scrambled to his feet. Broken tree branches and smoldering leaves cascaded off his back. Then he sprinted out of the thicket, thudded across the dirt trail, and started uphill himself, angling toward another draw that climbed out of the valley. His skin crawled. Apart from a few trees and shallow limestone outcrops dotting the slope, there was no cover here. He'd be a sitting duck if the Russians attacking from the south blew past Brad's position and put him in their crosshairs. Maycomber was about two-thirds of the way up when his computer blared a warning. Movement alert, left front, range close, 100 meters. Swearing, he swiveled to the left, seeing the bright green thermal image of a Russian autocannon protruding from behind a pair of weathered boulders perched at the top of the hill. That enemy robot hadn't been heading for the ranch house after all. Instead, it had picked out the perfect spot to bushwhack him. He raised his railgun, knowing it was already too late.
Whang, 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 whang!
Armor-piercing 30-millimeter rounds hammered his CID with enormous force, slamming home at point-blank range. His railgun went flying, destroyed by a direct hit. He tumbled backward, rolling over and over down the slope in a spreading cloud of dirt and gravel as the Russian kept shooting. Maycomber crashed heavily into the scarred top of a rock ridge. The impact stopped his fall. Immediately he scrambled across to the other side and dropped prone. The outcrop provided him with a small amount of cover, at least until that clever Russian bastard up there moved to a new firing position. Damage readouts scrolled across his displays in a dizzying sea of red and orange. Severe hydraulic systems damaged. Forward thermal and visual camouflage tiles offline. Fuel cells 2, 5, and 7 down. All weapons, packs, and ammunition destroyed. Torso armor holding, but effectiveness significantly degraded.
Translation. I'm totally fucked, Maycomber said, tasting blood in his mouth.
He'd been slammed around inside the CID's cockpit pretty badly during that wild-assed tumble down the hill. He ignored the pain. Whatever injuries he'd taken would just have to wait their turn. Right now, he needed to assess his tactical situation. Not that it required any deep thought. Apart from having no working weapons, no serviceable camouflage, and no way to run away, everything was just peachy keen. Even bailing out of this shot-to-shit tin can wasn't an option, since it would only leave him more exposed. And he had a serious hunch their enemies weren't planning on taking any prisoners. Which left what exactly? Movement detected, his computer reported unemotionally. No visuals from this position. Assessment derived from audio sensors only. An icon blinked into existence on his flickering tactical display. It showed the CID's estimate of that Russian robot's position based on the sounds its highly sensitive microphones were picking up. In this case, the noises made by metal feet cautiously picking their way down the battle-torn slope. Maycomber whistled softly. That other pilot was coming straight downhill toward him, apparently determined to finish off his crippled enemy at knife range.
"Geez, what a dumbass," he said with a slow, twisted grin.
He ran a quick mental calculation, weighing the speed at which that Russian robot was making its way toward him against the time he needed. Finished, he nodded sharply. What he planned was doable. Calling it survivable, on the other hand, might not pass the laugh test. Still, any chance was better than none at all. Maycomber took a deep breath, suddenly seeing a vision of Charlie Turlock's bright-eyed face floating before his eyes. She was laughing. Impatiently, he shook the vision away.
"Sorry," he muttered. "I really don't need any bad omens right now."
Through his neural link with the CID, he ordered,
"Initiate self-destruct sequence. Authorization Maycomber Alpha 1.
"Self-destruct authorization confirmed," the computer replied. 30. 29. 28. Without waiting any longer, Maycomber pushed his damaged machine upright. He was less than 30 meters from the oncoming Russian combat robot, which stopped dead in its tracks the moment his CID rose above the shallow limestone ledge. It started to raise its weapon.
"Boo, motherfucker!"
Maycomber snarled. He lunged uphill, covering the intervening distance in a few awkward, shambling strides. The CID's servos and actuators shrieked in protest. More sections of his system schematics winked out as his computer rerouted most of the remaining power reserves just to keep moving. 25. 24, the computer said, continuing its dispassionate countdown. The Russian robot opened fire again, scoring more hits on his torso armor. Through his neural interface, Makehomer felt the impacts like red-hot daggers plunging deep into his vitals. Groaning aloud, he clenched his jaw hard against the pain. And then he crashed headlong into the enemy machine, his CID's large, articulated metal fingers curled around the other robot's arms and gripped tight. It stood frozen for a millisecond, and then started thrashing around, trying to free itself. 20, 19, 18. Time to go, Makehomer decided. He squirmed out of the haptic interface and wriggled around to the hatch at the bottom of the cockpit. Fingers crossed, he thought coldly, remembering how Charlie had died when her hatch jammed in a similar situation. He punched the emergency release. With a grating sound, the hatch slid open. He squeezed through the narrow opening and dropped out onto the ground. He hit with a thud that rattled his teeth and jarred his spine. Without hesitating, he rolled away from the entangled machines, scrambled to his feet, and ran full tilt across the slope, determined to put as much distance between himself and them as he possibly could. Inside his head, his mind kept a running count. 8, 7, 6. Behind him, the Russian combat robot tore one arm free from the Iron Wolf CID's grip and started working to pry the other loose. 3, 2. Makehomer dove for cover behind a boulder and curled up, covering his head with his hands. With a deafening roar, his cybernetic infantry device exploded, a massive ball of fire ballooned skyward, turning night into day for a split second. A powerful shock wave rippled outward from the center of the blast, toppling saplings and ripping branches off larger trees. The blast wave curled around the boulder, scooped Makehomer off the ground, and tossed him against the trunk of a nearby oak tree with enough force to knock him unconscious. When the terrible noise and light faded, all that was left of the two entangled war machines were burning fragments of metal and half-melted wiring scattered far and wide across the ravaged hillside. 41. South of the ranch house. That same time.
Spectre 3's pilot, Major Viktor Zelin, saw the green blip representing Dmitry Veselovsky's KVM wink out. He scowled. First, Bragin had bought it, blown to hell by one of those American railguns. And now they'd lost a second combat robot, Veselovsky's Spectre 5. How was that possible? The other man had just reported that he was closing in to kill the crippled Iron Wolf machine, when suddenly the whole sky over there lit up like the grand finale of a Moscow Victory Day fireworks display. Did the Americans have concealed heavy weapons units, anti-tank missile teams, armored vehicles and artillery, deployed around the ranch after all? Despite what the satellite photos showed and what that little weasel Aristov had reported seeing with his own eyes?
3, this is 4,
he heard Captain Sergei Novikov say over their dedicated secure circuit.
You know, this suddenly looks a lot like a trap.
Zelin nodded.
So it does, Sergei.
He slowed his pace, seeing Novikov's robot do the same on his display. Up to now, their two KVMs had been advancing at their best possible speed given the rugged terrain, making their way through patches of trees and brush, across open pasture land, and up and over rocky, forested heights. Currently they were moving north along a wooded valley that ran straight toward the center of the ranch, approximately 2 kilometers away. Visibility along the valley floor, even with their thermal sensors, wasn't good. Limited in most places to much less than 100 meters, if the Americans really did have anti-armor weapons in place, hidden under anti-IR camouflage netting, say, rushing along practically blind was just asking to be ambushed.
Maybe we should swing left, up onto those hills, Novikov suggested.
The new axis of advance he proposed appeared on Zelin's display. It would take them out onto the slopes of a pair of low, rocky elevations that rose 50 meters or so above the valley. Someone had logged those hills in the past, clearing away everything but a few scraggy oaks and scattered tufts of thick brush and brambles.
At least that would get us out of these trees. We'd be able to see. And we'd have much better fields of fire.
True, Spectre 4, Zelin said tersely. But the same would apply to any concealed American unit along a line of sight on those slopes. We'd be missile or tank cannon fodder out there.
so we'll stick to cover for now.
Affirmative, 3.
Colonel Barushev's irritated voice broke into their conversation.
Spectre lead to Spectre 3. What's the holdup? Why are you and 4 dicking around all of a sudden?
Zelen checked the two blips representing Barushev and Embrykov on his map. They were still making their way uphill through the dense growth on a ridge east of the ranch house. Sourly, he noticed they weren't advancing much faster than he and Novikov were, and that they were even farther from the planned objective. He thought about pointing that fact out to his superior and then decided it was pointless. The colonel had been growing more domineering and less willing to listen to alternate views over the past several days.
You may have missed it, Colonel, but we've taken 30% casualties, thanks to stronger-than-expected enemy resistance, he said coolly. And since Spectre 4 and I would rather kill the enemy than die stupidly for the motherland, we're playing this our way from here on. Spectre 3 out.
That's insubordination, Zelen,
Barushev spluttered, sounding furious, even in a compressed and encrypted transmission.
Get your damned KVMs moving faster or
block further signals from Spectre lead,
Zelen ordered his computer.
Unless they carry a technical emergency tag, verified by his own robot software.
Instructions understood,
his KVM replied. Zelen nodded, satisfied. That should prevent Barushev from bitching at him for no good reason, while still allowing two-way communication in a genuine crisis. He supposed the colonel would scream about it to Kuraikin later, but at the moment, they were a long way from Moscow. He smiled wryly. Besides, they were nominally mercenaries now, right? They weren't supposed to be soldiers locked into a regular chain of command, were they? And anyway, if he and Novikov actually succeeded in killing Farrell, one of America's two major presidential candidates, and then escaping to Mexico without getting caught, no one back home would care much about any minor breaches of discipline. Staying within sight of each other, the two Russian war machines stalked slowly north through the woods, accompanied by the loud, crackling sound of snapping branches and trampled brush as they bulled their way through places where tangles of interlaced trees, stunted saplings, vines, creepers, and bushes formed an otherwise impenetrable barrier. They stayed off the occasional meandering horse and cattle trails they crossed. If the Americans did have prepared defenses on this ranch, those narrow paths would be death traps. Despite the noise they were making, Zelen figured it was safer to stay deep in cover rather than give any defenders lurking up ahead a chance to use high-caliber, long-range weapons against them. In this thick forest, any encounters would take place at almost point-blank range, where their KVM's agility, armor, and speed should prove decisive. Brad McClanahan swallowed hard, feeling a painful lump in his throat. That huge blast off to the west could mean only one thing. Macomber's CID had blown itself up. There was no way to tell whether the colonel had been able to get out of his machine and into good cover before it detonated. So all he could do was hope and pray that Wack's name wasn't going to end up on his list of dead friends and comrades, a list that was already far too long. His eyes stung. Impatiently, he shook his head to clear them. But his CID's neural interface material around his head was too tight. Screw it. If he lived through this fight, there'd be time enough to mourn later. Just now, that looked like a mighty big if. At least the pair of Russian war robots Macomber had tangled with weren't transmitting anymore. It was likely they were both wrecked, too. Or at least so seriously damaged that they no longer posed a real threat, which left 4 of the powerful enemy machines prowling out there in the darkness, and that meant he and Nadia still faced odds of 2-to-1 against them. A map section on Brad's tactical display turned red. Signals, intercepts, plus audio sensors indicate 2 hostiles advancing in this sector, his computer reported. Exact range, indeterminate, but certainly less than 600 meters. He frowned. Those Russian pilots were coming right at him through the thickest parts of the stands of scraggy second-growth timber that covered this narrow valley from rim to rim. It was obvious that they were staying well away from any clearings and trails.
Probable engagement range? He queried the computer.
Less than 100 meters, it replied.
Great, he sighed.
Their railguns were the one weapons advantage they had over the Russians. Unfortunately, being forced to fight in the middle of a woodland robbed him of that advantage. Firing through those scrub oaks and cedars wasn't the problem. At Mach 5, a railgun projectile could punch a hole in the tallest redwood and keep on going. No, what sucked was the fact that he wouldn't be able to get a lock on those enemy machines until they were practically right on top of him. Powering up the railgun would give his position away. But he should still be able to get off the first shot, which meant he could nail one Russian robot for sure, and then its companion would undoubtedly kill him before his railgun could cycle for a second shot. Falling back to engage in more open ground wasn't an option either. The only open country behind him would give those Russians clear fields of fire at Governor Farrell's ranch house.
"Ditch the woe-is-poor-me crap, Brad," he told himself sternly.
This was one of those best-laid-plans deals, where everything went to hell despite your best efforts. So he was going to have to fight and win right here in the middle of these woods, or die trying. And since he'd really rather not be killed, he'd better come up with some better options, and fast. "Enemy advance continuing," the CID's computer reminded him. "Range to hostiles firming up based on additional audio and signals data. Now 400 meters, plus or minus 100 meters. The area highlighted on Brad's display shrank, reflecting this new assessment, but he still didn't have enough information to engage at a decent range. Even now, his computer's best estimate of the enemy location only put the two oncoming Russian war machines somewhere inside a moving box 200 meters wide and 300 meters deep. Firing blind with his railgun and trusting to sheer luck to score a hit would be stupid. Nor could he effectively sweep a zone that large with his 25mm autocannon. The odds against destroying or disabling both enemy robots before he ran out of ammunition, or more likely, they returned fire and blew the crap out of him, were astronomical. Suddenly he remembered one of Wack's favorite battlefield maxims. When in doubt, smoke them out. He grinned tightly. He had area of effect weapons. It was time to use them. Even if only to rattle those Russian pilots a little, and maybe throw them off their own game plan. "Load thermobaric grenades," he instructed his computer. Quickly, Brad selected a series of desired impact points on his tactical display. The ready icon flashed. He stood up, unlimbered his grenade launcher, and aimed the weapon downrange, following the cues shown by his CID's computers as it calculated a precise trajectory automatically adjusted for wind velocity and temperature. He squeezed the trigger. The launcher coughed quietly. He absorbed the minor amount of recoil, swung toward the next aiming cue, and fired again. And then a third time. Time to go, Brad thought. His first grenade would impact in about 3 seconds, and when it did, all hell was going to break loose. For once, that phrase would be almost literally true. He started moving to his right, striding through the woods at an easy pace to keep his camouflage systems effective and to stay as quiet as possible. Through the tree canopy, the sky to the south lit up with a bright orange flash. The sound reached him a second later. Whoomp!
"What the devil?"
Major Victor Zelin snarled, caught off guard by the powerful explosion 100 meters behind him. The blast wave tore past, ripping leaves off trees and sending them swirling into the air. Heat swept across his KVM's armor. He crouched lower, reacting instinctively. A second explosion shredded the darkness, this time even closer and off to the right. His night vision sensors stepped down the flash so that it didn't blind him. His machine rocked, hit by another shock wave. The temperature readings outside his cockpit spiked upward again. Burning debris rained down across the nearby woods.
Whump!
A third blast slashed at the forest a couple of 100 meters to his left, sending another ball of fire boiling into the sky.
"We're being mortared!"
Novikov yelled.
"Negative. Weapons are 40mm thermobaric grenades,"
Zelin's KVM countered. A threat icon appeared on his map, highlighting a clearing about 350 meters ahead of them.
"Sound analysis indicates this area as probable firing point."
He grimaced. The Americans must have a bunker or trench complex out there, camouflaged against satellite detection. He wished again that the robots were equipped with radar. Not only would a counter-battery radar have warned them about the incoming grenades before they detonated, It would have also provided a far more precise fix on that suspected enemy location. Unfortunately, Russia's scientists hadn't been able to reverse-engineer the power-efficient, compact Skymaster's radars built into the Iron Wolf CIDs. And their own active radar systems were too cumbersome and needed too much energy. The passive radar warning receivers fitted into their KVM sensor arrays were a distinctly second-best solution.
Spectre 423, Zelin radioed. We will advance on the enemy. Lay down suppressive fire on that position.
Acting on his own orders, he rose and stalked forward, firing short bursts from his autocannon into the woods ahead of them. Noivakov did the same, going forward on his left while shooting on the move. Tree trunks started exploding, blasted to splinters by HE and armor-piercing rounds. Tracer rounds slashed through the darkness, corkscrewing wildly into the air as they ricocheted off boulders. Zelin wasn't anticipating they'd actually hit anyone. Right now, he only wanted to lay down enough fire to make the still unseen Americans keep their heads down. Brad pressed his CID flat against the ground, hearing 30mm rounds whip-crack past low overhead. Staccato flashes from their weapons showed the enemy fighting machines prowling closer, advancing through the splintered, burning forest. He smiled tightly. Most of their fire seemed to be directed about 30 meters to his left, toward his old position at the edge of a little clearing in the woods. But there were enough shells peppering the general area to make the idea of standing up for no good reason seem distinctly unwise. Through narrowed eyes, he watched the Russians come on. They were definitely converging on the clearing. More high-explosive rounds slammed into the ground on the far side. Fountains of pulverized dirt and rock erupted. The nearest enemy robot darted forward into the opening and loosed a long, withering burst aimed low, shredding trees and bushes and blasting more craters in the hard-packed soil. Its autocannon fell silent, with smoke coiling away from its muzzle. Slowly, the robot lowered its weapon. Its antenna-studded head whirred from side to side and then stopped, looking in his general direction. Abruptly, Brad realized the Russian pilot must have spotted the trail of broken branches and crushed bracken he'd made when leaving the clearing, a trail that would lead the enemy straight to his current position, no matter how effective his camouflage systems were. Damn, he muttered. He leapt to his feet, unslinging his own 25mm autocannon at the same time. With a wild, piercing yell, he opened fire at point-blank range. More than a dozen rounds smashed into the enemy war machine, punching through its composite armor in a dazzling shower of sparks and shards of metal and plastic. The Russian robot froze in mid-motion. Tendrils of oily black smoke poured out through the rents torn in its torso. Flames glowed red through the smoke.
Warning! Hostile to the right!
His CID's computer snapped. Brad glimpsed the second Russian war machine as it crashed through a thicket no more than 50 meters away. It was already shooting at him. Something clipped him in the side, spinning him partway around. Another round slammed into his CID's right arm with bone-rattling force. The hand gripping his autocannon went dead. Red lights flared on his display.
Lower arm actuators destroyed, the computer said calmly. Autocannon ammunition feed offline.
He whirled aside and ran, racing through the woods at high speed, zigzagging in an effort to throw off the enemy's aim. Shattered branches and torn leaves fluttered in his wake. More 30mm rounds struck his rear armor, cracking thermal tiles and knocking him off stride, but not quite penetrating. The enemy machine was in close pursuit, firing at him on the move.
Time to go vertical, Brad realized.
Running all out, he bounded into the air at nearly 40 miles an hour, tearing through the woodland canopy on the way up and crashing down among the trees. He hit the ground still running and leaped again, soaring even higher and farther this time. Again, he fell back to earth, thudding down in a huge cloud of dirt and dust. With his CID's left hand, he pried the damaged, still warm autocannon loose and tossed it far away into the woods. Then he bowled his way on, shoving through saplings, brambles, and past vine-draped oaks without any attempt to hide the signs of his passage. Seconds later, he came out into another small clearing, a roughly circular patch of open ground no more than 15 meters in diameter. His eyes narrowed. This would have to do, he thought. One way or another, he was done running. Quickly, Brad plunged in among the trees and brush on the opposite side. As soon as he was out of sight of the glade, he cut right and circled back halfway around. He stopped a short distance from the opening and knelt down. "Re-engage camouflage systems," he commanded. Carefully, he took out his railgun and set it behind the trunk of the nearest tree, within easy reach. "Rear torso and right arm thermal and chameleon camouflage partially compromised," the CID warned him. Several areas on a system's schematic glowed yellow. He edged over a little so that the robot's lifeless right arm was at least partially screened by the same tree. Then, satisfied, he settled in to wait. Furious, Major Victor Zelin ran through the forest, heading for the spot where his computer calculated the Iron Wolf robot must have landed after its second bound. He was on his own now. Noivakov was dead, cut to pieces inside his cockpit by that sudden shattering burst of point-blank cannon fire.
"So much for Moskva's fucking intelligence reports," he thought viciously.
All those cheerful rear-echelon assurances that they wouldn't have to face more than a single one of the enemy combat machines had just gone up in smoke and flames. Exactly like Noivakov's wrecked KVM. At least he'd scored a number of solid hits on the other robot as it turned and ran. That would make the job of finishing it off easier. Nearing the site, Zelin slowed down. He had no intention of stumbling into another ambush. Damaged or not, that Iron Wolf machine could still have teeth. Cautiously, he approached the place where the other pilot had crashed back to Earth. Broken tree limbs and plowed dirt showed the exact spot. He paused, scanning the area with his night vision sensors and listening for even the slightest sounds. A long, thin shape glowed green off the woods on his left. He swung in that direction, ready to fire. "Discarded 25mm enemy weapon," his KVM's computer reported. Zelin showed his teeth. Nobody dropped their armament without good reason. He must have inflicted more damage on the Iron Wolf robot than he'd first thought. The Major turned back and moved on, following the trail of disturbed vegetation left by the other machine as it fled. He stayed on high alert. The KVM's sensitive microphones weren't picking up any new sounds, which meant the enemy had gone to ground somewhere up ahead. "Hostile approaching at 9 o'clock," Brad's CID reported. He held his breath, watching as the Russian war robot stepped warily into the clearing. Its smooth, featureless head swiveled from side to side, almost as though it were a hungry tiger sniffing for the scent of prey. His mouth felt dry as dust. "Come on," he urged it silently. "Just come a little farther. See, there's no one here. Just you." Apparently satisfied, the other machine started across the open ground, heading toward the false trail Brad had laid deeper into the woods.
"Now!"
He grabbed his railgun from its hiding place behind the tree and powered it up. Alerted by the sudden noise and electromagnetic signature, the Russian robot spun toward him with its 30mm cannon ready. "Too late," Brad thought coldly. He fired. In a burst of bright, white plasma, the railgun slug hit the enemy machine squarely and blew it apart. Awkwardly, he pushed his CID to its feet and moved out into the clearing. Its right arm dangled uselessly. That made four of the Russians down and dead. But with Maycomber's machine wrecked and his own seriously damaged, the odds were still against them. He turned right, ready to head north toward Farrell's ranch house to offer Nadia what help he could, and saw new explosions rip the darkness to shreds. The harsh rattle of gunfire echoed off the surrounding hills. Brad felt the blood drain from his face. Desperately, he lurched into motion, already knowing he was too late. 42. East of the ranch house. That same time. Colonel Ruslan Borusev pushed his KVM up the steep slope, painfully clawing his way from tree to tree. Loose soil and chalky scree shifted under the robot's considerable weight with every step. He grimaced. He and Imbrikov were already several minutes behind schedule, slowed down by his decision to advance over this high ground overlooking Farrell's compound instead of rushing straight up the paved drive from the main gate. His original plan had called for a near-simultaneous assault. Instead, his two robot teams were engaging the enemy as separate units, and paying a much higher price than he'd anticipated. In their first three attacks against the Americans, none of his KVMs had taken anything more than superficial damage. Now, in a matter of moments, a single Iron Wolf combat robot had appeared and destroyed two of them. How was that possible? Suddenly, the beacon representing Spectre 4, Noivakov's machine, vanished from his tactical display. At almost the same moment, his team commander, Zelen, snapped a terse report that he was in pursuit of yet another Iron Wolf war machine. Over their dedicated circuit, he heard Emrikov's growled oath.
Cert was me! Damn it! What have we walked into here, lead?
Barushev bit down on the urge to unleash his own string of profanity. This was supposed to be a soft target, for God's sake. Instead, half of his robots had been turned into burned-out wrecks, with their highly trained pilots blown to charred bits. For a split second, he considered ordering a retreat. But then, just as quickly, he discarded the notion as cowardice. This was not a game, and casualties were inevitable in war. Besides, neither he nor Emrikov had yet encountered any opposition. And once they reached the top of this hill, the whole ranch would be at their mercy, laid out before their guns and missiles like a lamb trussed for the slaughter.
Keep going, too, he ordered. The American forces cannot possibly be strong everywhere. Very well, Spectre Lead, the other man said, after a noticeable delay.
Seconds later, Barushev made it to the hilltop, joined almost immediately by Emrikov's Spectre 2. The two KVMs went forward through the trees and down the other side until they reached a vantage point on the military crest that gave them a clear line of sight across the whole valley. Fires glowed orange in the woods off to the south. Otherwise, everything seemed unnaturally silent. From 700 meters away, Barushev was puzzled to see that Farrell's large, single-story ranch house was completely dark, without any lights showing anywhere. Nor were there any lights on at the stable, equipment shed, or garage. The sedans and SUVs shown in Aristov's surveillance photos were still parked next to the house. Only the horse paddock was empty. Movement in the open pastures to the north caught Barushev's attention. Instantly alert, he swiveled that way, bringing his weapons to bear.
Horses only, the computer reported, analyzing the fast-moving thermal signatures it detected. No human riders.
Ah, he thought. The sounds of battle must have spooked those animals. Well, there was no sense in wasting his limited ammunition on them. He was here to kill two-legged beasts.
Lead, I'm not picking up any IR signatures in the house or any of the other buildings,
Emrikov reported, sounding perplexed. Barushev turned his own thermal sensors to the task. His readings, or rather, the lack of them, confirmed the other man's findings. He wasn't able to pick up any human-sized heat signatures inside the ranch house or its outbuildings. His mouth tightened. Where were the men they'd come to assassinate? Farrell, Martindale, and McClanahan. He considered the house. Those stone walls were thick. When this battle began, the three Americans must have retreated to a safe room or cellar deep in the interior. Certainly there were no signs of them on the grounds, or even on the wooded slopes rising west of the compound. Anyway, if they had bolted for safety in that direction, Captain Aristov would have spotted them and reported in.
Crack!
Another huge flash lit the woods to the south. Major Zelin's KVM went offline immediately. For a long, frozen moment, Barushev stared at his readouts in shock. Two-thirds of his force gone? Just like that? In a few minutes of battle? For the first time in a long while, he felt the ice-cold sensation of fear crawling up his spine. He and the other KVM pilots had reveled in their strength, confident in their near invulnerability given them by these powerful war machines. But now it was only too clear that this sense of godlike invincibility had been nothing more than a dangerous illusion. They could be killed. In fact, they were being killed. Struck down one after another by enemies who seemed like ghosts, able to move unseen in the shadows.
Lead, what do we do?
Imrikov's tense voice broke through his sense of growing terror.
Should we withdraw? No,
Barushev snarled, shoving his fears aside with an act of will. Retreating now, when they had their targets in sight, would be an act of supreme idiocy, as well as unforgivable cowardice.
We're not running, Oleg. We're going to finish this now.
He yanked one of his three spike fire-and-forget anti-tank missiles from his weapons rack. Emrikov did the same. Cued by their computers, they fired simultaneously. Both missiles streaked down slope, punched through the ranch house's metal rooftop, and exploded inside. Windows shattered, blown out by twin blasts. Thousands of tiny glass shards flew outward, twinkling eerily in the flickering light cast by orange and red fireballs soaring through the gaping holes torn in the roof. They fired again. Two more explosions rocked the house. Fires glowed through the empty windows. One of the outer stone walls sagged inward. Emrikov switched to his 30mm autocannon and started shooting through the mangled rooftop, using incendiary rounds to set more fires among explosions, shattered bookcases, and furniture. The colonel held his third missile ready. If Farrell and the others were still alive in what was fast becoming a roaring inferno, they might try to make a last-minute dash for one of the vehicles parked outside. And then a burst of sun-bright white light flared on the wooded hill facing them. Oleg's Emrikov KVM disintegrated, hit by a metal projectile moving at supersonic speed. Jagged pieces of man and machine sprayed across the slope. Horrified, Brushev saw his computer highlight a new target several hundred meters away. He recognized the unmistakable outline of an Iron Wolf CID standing among the trees.
That's impossible, he thought.
One moment the enemy robot wasn't there, and the next, there the damn thing was. Without wasting time on further thought, he fired his anti-tank missile. It slashed across the valley, visibly guiding on the other war machine. Target destroyed, Major Nadia Rozhik's CID computer reported calmly. She laughed in delight, knowing she just made sure there was one less Russian bastard to make trouble in the world. She raised her railgun again, seeking out the second enemy robot. Her warning systems went off with a shrill beep, beep, beep. Launch detection. Threat access 1 o'clock. Missile has IR lock. She saw a tiny bright dot streaking straight at her, growing bigger with astounding speed. She didn't have time to reactivate her thermal camouflage.
Damn,
Nadia said softly. In the last possible instant, she hurled herself to the side, desperately crossing both of the CID's metal arms in front of its torso.
Wham! Wham!
She felt herself smashed backward in a dazzling flash of orange and red light, and then everything went black.
Got you,
Barushev crowed, seeing the bright orange burst engulf the Iron Wolf CID. He saw pieces fly off as it flew backward, crashed into a stand of trees, and collapsed in a heap. He turned away, thoroughly satisfied. No robot could have survived the rapid-fire detonations of his missile's tandem warhead, a smaller-shaped charge to strip away any explosive reactive armor, and a primary charge designed to penetrate the underlying armor of a modern heavy tank. His mood darkened again at the sight of the smoldering wreckage of Emrikov's KVM. This victory had come at too high a cost. Filled with wrath, he strode downslope toward Farrell's gutted ranch house. It was time to make sure the men his leaders wanted him to kill were truly dead. Barushev switched back to his own autocannon on the move. He came out onto level ground and closed in on the burning building. When he got within 50 meters, he started circling it, methodically probing the ruins with his visual sensors, microphones, and chemical sniffers set at maximum sensitivity. He found nothing. The Russian scowled. There should be some indication of dead bodies in there, even if it was only a glimpse of a mangled arm or leg half buried in the rubble, or even just the smell of burning flesh. The flames roared higher, fed by cooler night air being drawn into the conflagration.
Unidentified movement, right rear quadrant, the KVM's computer said. Range 220 meters.
Startled, Barushev whirled around and found himself staring at the empty horse corral. Dust kicked low across the bare earth, blown by the wind sweeping in toward the burning house at his back.
Replay your detection footage, he ordered.
Obediently, the computer cycled the brief snippet of video imagery captured by its night vision cameras across his display. Watching closely, Barushev saw a patch of ground ripple in the breeze, almost as though it were cloth instead of solid earth. An eyebrow rose in surmise. Could that be? He headed toward the paddock. Hugging the dirt with Martindale and Farrell in a shadow scrape near the middle of the paddock, Patrick McClanahan saw the IR camouflage netting stretched over their heads flutter slightly in the wind. Immediately, he dialed up the sensitivity of the audio pickups built into his life support helmet. Well, damn, he thought bitterly, hearing the tempo of the Russian robot's footsteps change and grow louder. That's torn it. So much for Plan A, which had called for the three of them to hide out here while Brad and the rest of his Iron Wolf team fought it out with Grislov's forces. Too bad there really wasn't a Plan B. He glanced at Martindale and Farrell, seeing their eyes gleaming in the darkness. He put his hand on their shoulders, one after the other, pressing down in a peremptory command to stay down, no matter what happened. Tightly, they nodded. Time's up, Muck, Patrick thought, deliberately using the nickname his friends had given him years ago, many of whom were long dead, killed in combat, in air crashes, or by terrorists. It seemed appropriate somehow, considering he'd probably be seeing them soon. Besides, if he was going to die, he'd much rather meet his end out under the open sky than cowering in a covered ditch. Quickly, not giving himself time to crap out, he wriggled out from under the camouflage netting. Gritting his teeth, he forced himself upright, ignoring the way the servos and his supporting exoskeleton protested the sudden movement. Then, moving awkwardly, he jog-trotted away across the dusty paddock. Colonel Ruslan Barushev saw the strange figure scramble out from under the camouflage net and turn to run.
"Identify that man," he snapped. "Profile matches most recent photograph of Lieutenant General Patrick McClanahan," his KVM's computer replied. "Target priority per Moskva's most recent orders is Alpha 1.
Barushev nodded. President Grislov's personal desire for revenge against McClanahan, the man whose bombs had killed Grislov's father and led directly to his mother's suicide. That was no surprise. It was certainly a desire he shared. As an officer in Russia's Air Force, he'd seen hundreds of his friends and comrades killed by the American and the forces he commanded. He raised his autocannon. His fingers started to tighten on the trigger. And then it eased off. Why give McClanahan so easy a death? After all, what was it that Grislov had said to Kurykin, a message passed on verbatim by the general when he'd ordered this attack? Oh, yes.
"I don't want that murdering piece of shit crippled. I want him torn to fucking pieces."
His lips twisted in a savage grin. Well, why not follow those orders to the letter? Turning away from the camouflaged shelter he'd spotted, he stalked slowly after the fleeing American, gliding along like a cat toying with a terrified mouse. "Warning, warning, multiple systems failures, severe damage, weapons offline, sensors at 10% efficiency, power supplies at critical level. Warning, warning, immediate pilot action required." Groggily, Nadia Rozek swam back to consciousness, pulling herself away from what had seemed a dark, lightless abyss filled with terrifying creatures. Her CID computer's recitation of its litany of woes continued, the crackling static in her ears and the weirdly shaped blotches obscuring some of the virtual readouts it was sending to her suggested the neural link was damaged. She shook her head, trying to wake up faster, and winced as a sharp pain stabbed at her. Blood dripped from a gash on her forehead. The bitter odor of burned-out electronics and circuitry hung heavily in the stagnant air. She grimaced. Evidently, her life support system was dead, too. Her CID's left arm was gone, blown off at the socket. The robot's right arm was nothing more than a stump. She had a vague memory of desperately throwing them up in front of her to shield the section of torso that contained her cockpit. Blearily, she realized they must have taken the brunt of that anti-tank missile's blast. Nadia strained to get the CID back on its feet, Using the damaged haptic interface made her feel as though she were slogging through hip-deep quicksand, with 50-pound weights fastened to her ankles. Leg servos and actuators screeched shrilly, audibly on the edge of total failure. She gritted her teeth, ignoring both the painful, head-splitting noises and the cascade of yellow and red caution and warning lights that suddenly blossomed on her last working equipment display. She staggered upright and gasped out loud at what she saw through her only functioning camera. General McClanahan, Brad's much-loved father, stumbling away across a dusty field with a sleek, deadly-looking Russian war machine in pursuit.
No,
Nadia said brokenly, imagining the sorrow the man she loved with all her soul would feel on learning his father's gruesome death at the hands of their enemies. The news would pierce Brad's heart like a sharpened sword. She stiffened.
No, I will not allow it.
Doggedly, she lurched down the hill, overriding every one of the dying Iron Wolf's CIDs, fail-safes, and damage protocols to move faster. Laughing now, Barushev strode on after the crippled American. That odd metallic carapace the other man wore was a pale imitation of the powered exoskeleton at the core of his own KVM. Perhaps he should begin by forcibly peeling those bits of metal away from the writhing, screaming coward, he mused, before moving on to wrench off McClanahan's physical arms and legs. Through his link, the computer tried to attract his attention.
Movement, I'll...
With an impatient gesture, Barushev silenced the alarm. This was a moment to savor, without pointless distractions. The robot's sensors must have spotted the other two Americans, Farrell and Martindale, making their own futile dash for safety while he chased after this one.
Let them run, he thought coldly. They couldn't get far.
Once he'd finished mutilating McClanahan's corpse, they would become his next quarry. And then something crashed hard into his KVM from the side, knocking him off balance. Despite his safety harness, the sudden impact was forceful enough to slam his head up against one of the backup instrument panels. His robot stumbled, falling to its knees. Enraged by this intrusion on his private hunt, Barushev spat out blood from the lip he'd just bitten.
Sukien Singh, son of a bitch!
His KVM got back up and spun toward this new attacker. His eyes widened in surprise as he recognized the Iron Wolf machine he thought he'd killed with his anti-tank missile. The enemy war robot was a battered wreck, with both arms gone and most of the sensor panels mounted on its weird, hexagonal head reduced to slag and broken bits of circuitry. But the damned thing was still moving somehow, deliberately putting itself between him and McClanahan.
Not for long, Barushev thought viciously.
He fired his autocannon, perforating the Iron Wolf CID as it stumbled toward him again. Sparks and smoke danced around the punctures his rounds tore through its already weakened armor. With a harsh laugh, he stepped aside from the other machine's lunge and watched it crumple to the ground. Triumphantly, he looked back to find McClanahan. The American had stopped running away. Instead, he was rushing toward the downed robot, with a look of horror on his lined face. Grinning, Barushev raised his autocannon again, taking careful aim. Patrick McClanahan dropped to his knees beside Nadia's CID. Through his partial neural link, he made contact with the machine's computer. It was failing fast, shutting down more and more core memory and command functions in a futile effort to stay online for its pilot. He had only time to order it to open the emergency hatch before it went dead. The hatch cycled. Smoke and the harsh coppery smell of blood eddied out through the opening.
Trying to hide, little man,
he heard a cold, synthesized voice say in accented English.
Gennady Gryzlov sends his regards.
With a wry smile, Patrick looked up, right into the muzzle of the Russian war robot's 30-millimeter cannon.
Does he? Well, you tell that asshole I'll see him in hell, he said coolly.
At a faint glimpse of movement, far off in the darkness, well beyond Farrell's blazing ranch house, he smiled more genuinely.
But you know, I have a feeling you'll get there first. Brave words for a crack!
The Russian combat robot blew apart in a ball of fire, hit squarely in the back by a railgun shot that went through and through at Mach 5. Its head and broken limbs spiraled away into the air and came crashing down in different places scattered across the dusty corral. Painfully, Patrick pushed himself back up onto his hands and knees from where he'd been thrown by the blast. He crawled back over to Nadia Rozhek's dead cybernetic infantry device as fast as he could. His lips moved silently. Prayer wasn't usually his thing, but right now he'd take any help on offer, especially when the alternative was watching his son's heart shatter into a thousand pieces. 43. At the Farrell Ranch, that same time. Brad McClanahan skidded to a stop. He stared down at Nadia's mangled CID, feeling a sudden sense of dread so intense that it drowned out every other emotion, even his relief at seeing his father alive and the last Russian war robot scattered in pieces. Unable to open data link to Wolf 2, his CID computer said unhelpfully. Damage analysis indicates complete processing unit failure, along with skip it. Brad ordered harshly, not wanting to hear any more. Command not understood, the computer replied. I mean cancel Wolf 2 damage analysis report, Brad said tiredly, kicking himself for forgetting that English language idioms were not the system's strong suit. He noticed Martindale and Farrell hurrying up to them across the corral. Slowly his father backed out of the downed CID's emergency hatch, carefully dragging a blood-soaked Nadia Rozhek with him. Despite the open gash on her forehead, her face was still beautiful, but it was ashen, almost chalk white. Her long, slender legs were... Hurriedly, Brad averted his gaze from the mess he'd just seen. Oh, Christ, he thought, in mingled horror and supplication. Those had been shards of bone glistening white in the middle of all that gore. His stomach heaved abruptly, and he fought against the urge to vomit, swallowing hard against the sour taste of bile. He turned to his father. Is she... He choked up, unable to go on. Nadia's still alive, son, his father said quietly. But she's badly wounded. I can't promise you she'll make it. He looked up and saw the two other men. Governor, he told Farrell, we need a life flight here ASAP. Farrell nodded sharply. He pulled out his smartphone. I'm on it, General. He tapped in the emergency number and started talking to the dispatcher, rapping out terse instructions with calm assurance. When he was finished, he glanced back at them. Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio's got the nearest decent trauma center. Their ambulance helicopter will be here in about 20 minutes. Brad saw his father frown. We need to stabilize Major Rozhek before then, and I can't do that with my bare hands. Farrell nodded again. He swung around to the security guards who were rushing toward them from the other hurriedly camouflaged shelters they'd scattered across the ranch compound. Jimmy! He shouted, pointing at one. Grab that emergency field kit from the stable, and then get your ass back here, muy pronto! Yes, sir! The guard yelled back over his shoulder, already sprinting off. Farrell shoved his hands in his pockets and kicked absently at the dry soil of the corral. I did have another medical kit, he said reflectively. But that was in the master bedroom over there. He jerked a thumb at the brightly burning remains of his ranch house. Somehow I don't figure it's still in one piece. Martindale cleared his throat uncertainly. I regret the property damage, Governor. Farrell shrugged. Never mind about the house. He knelt down beside Nadia and gently took her hand in his. People are what count in the end, folks. Ultimately, things don't matter a damn. Indeed, Martindale said coolly. I'm sure you're right. He looked at the other McClanahan and at Brad. In the meantime, the three of us need to be moving. If word of this incident isn't already flashing across the internet and up the chain of command to President Barbeau, it will be soon enough. Before the military and the FBI descend en masse here, it would be best if we were long gone.
What about WAC?
Brad heard himself snap. And Nadia.
I'm sure the governor's security detail will search for Colonel Maycomber.
If he's still alive, they will take good care of him, Martindale said soothingly. As for Major Rozhik, if she lives, she should be safe enough in a hospital, under the governor's protection. Farrell nodded. You can rest easy on that